Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. Ever since she was young, Dr. Sonia Santelises has been a straight shooter who is all about the work. Raised by a family that put education first, Sonia became the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools on July 1st, the fifth superintendent to lead the system in a decade. Educated at Brown, Columbia, and Harvard, Sonia previously worked as the school system's chief academic officer and also had stints at the Education Trust, Teach for America, the New York City Algebra Project, and Boston Public Schools. As Sun education reporter Erica Green writes, Sonia takes over the school system in a tumultuous time, with losses in standardized test scores and enrollment and a strapped budget. In addition, tensions surrounded Sonia's hiring as the school board conducted the search to replace former CEO Gregory Thornton in secret. I asked Sonia about the trust building that comes amid that fallout and building respect with parents and students who often come from different backgrounds than her. We also talked about how Sonia got her start in education, the negative stereotypes that persist about teaching, and about what she means when she says she's an elitist. Here's our conversation. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about yourself.
So I'm the mom of three young daughters, and my husband and I have lived in Baltimore now for about 6.5 years. I grew up in New England and lived in New York for a time, but have really been enjoying not only living in Baltimore City, but now being able to return to city schools as CEO has been a real great pleasure.
Did you grow up in a city, or what was your childhood like?
So I grew up north of Boston. My parents did a lot of civil rights work in Boston itself during a lot of the late 60s and early 70s. They were both in corporate America. So we grew up north of the city, but spent a lot of time in Boston for church and other activities. And then from there, went to college in New England as well, and then lived in New York after graduating from college. So
what kind of civil rights work did your parents do?
So they worked with Freedom House, which was an organization in Boston that started by Muriel and Otto Snowden. And it did a lot of work around housing, around increasing educational opportunities for particularly for African Americans, but grew to include a lot of other communities as well. So they did work there. My dad used to teach African American history classes at some of the local community colleges. They were very active in Urban League and NAACP when I was growing up. Even though they both had full-time jobs in corporate America, they did a lot of that when they weren't working.
And was education always extremely important to your family?
Oh, yeah. It's a matter of fact, my mother jokes that she should have known I was going to be a teacher when, like, I asked for chalk and a chalkboard when I was younger. And she wasn't always, my dad always loved the fact that I was interested in education. My mother, she will admit, tried to steer me away from actually being a teacher, just more from, traditional perceptions of opportunities for African American women. And she wanted me to basically be able to, in her mind, kind of expand beyond that. She's gotten over that in recent years. But I've always loved education, and it's always been a priority in our house. Like, I grew up in a home where, like, I would bring home a 95 and be really excited. My father would be, my father would say, "Well, if you got that far, why didn't you just go ahead and get 100? And so that was always important. And then just like discussions and debate around the dinner table. So friends would come home with me from high school and say, "Oh my God, you guys like have a debate class over dinner." And we would. And it was friendly. It wasn't like it was antagonistic. But, I grew up talking about books. We grew up with that being important. That was the only way we knew we could get out of housework with my mom, was to say that we had a test or we had midterms or finals. So that kind of emphasis on education, both formally and informally, was part of my growing up. And it was always seen as a privilege. And even now with my own three girls, one of the things that they all know is that there was a time where it would have been against the law for them to learn to read. And so I'm really, you know, I really pushed. I wanted all of them to know how to read before they went to school and that kind of thing. And but they know what it's connected to.
And do you have those debates over the dinner table now as well?
Well, since I've taken this job, we don't have as much time around right. the dinner table. We tend to play games more now. We don't have as much of that. I think as they get a little older, we will. But we definitely play a lot of games and do that, you know, while during dinner. But these days, we probably don't have as many family meals as we should be because my schedule and my husband's schedule is a little hectic since I've taken this job.
Just a little.
Just a tad.
Did you always know you wanted to be a teacher or involved in education, or how did that become clear to you?
That really became clear at the end of college, believe it or not. I mean, I always loved the idea of teaching, but no, you know, during junior high, I thought I was going to be a pediatrician, then really switched, thought I was going into journalism, broadcast journalism, and that stayed pretty solidly through high school. Got to college and still stayed with, you know, English. I was an English major, but fell in love with international affairs. And really what got me back into education was I was waiting to hear from posts that I had applied to in East Africa. Did not get those, but during the time was substitute teaching in my hometown back on the North Shore, and got a call from someone who knew Wendy Kopp, who at that time was starting Teach for America. We both graduated class of 89. And so I remember meeting with her in Au Bon Pain in Harvard Square, and she told me about this idea she had, and I thought, that sounds fun. Like, I should do that. And once I got back into it, really realized that while it was great recruiting teachers, I actually wanted to teach. And that's, I think, when I knew. So it was in that period right after college where, and I'll never forget when my sister came to visit my class in Brooklyn. And she said, I have never seen you as excited talking about, like, Asian foreign policy or, you know, what's going on in Francophone Africa. Like, you, when you talk about kids with kids, when you talk about teaching, you light up in ways that you don't in any of the other stuff that you talk about. And I think that was around that time that I knew that's what I was supposed to do.
Was it at all difficult to reconcile how you pictured yourself initially, you know, like in foreign affairs, was not actually your passion? Was that, I don't know, challenging to come to that conclusion?
Yeah it was. And some of that, and I've talked to young professionals of color, a lot of first-generation college goers. I wasn't a first-genner, but some of those same tensions applied. Like, you know, I remember one of my aunts said to my mother, well, why in the world would you spend all that money to send her to a place like Brown for her to then just go and teach? Like, she could have gone anywhere and just done that. But, you know, I really believe that in life callings and always have, and that helped. But it was hard because there still is this stigma, not as much, I think it's a little bit easier, but I find it even when I was down in D.C., you know, the number of young people, particularly young people of color, who feel very compelled that if they've done well in school, if they've gone to very competitive schools or in competitive programs, to somehow abruptly turn around and say they're going into teaching, there's still, even today, a lot of pressure around this idea that you're too smart to teach, or do it for a little bit and then go get the real high-powered job. And I think that does a disservice to the profession, and does a disservice to the folks who have so much to contribute. So it is still out there. I was just fortunate that, and I think sometimes my mom might have regretted it, but I remember her saying, like, this is the problem when you educate me and raise me to believe I can do whatever I want to do. And this is the flip side of that, right? That I might choose something that you don't want. But fortunately, my parents raised me with a strong enough sense of self and really a sense of purpose. And, you know, I'm a person of faith. And so in the end, if I feel like that's what I'm called and made to do, then I have to do it regardless. But no, it was tough then, and I'm sometimes surprised at how tough it still is for a number of young people to go home and say this is what they've chosen.
Why do you think that perception persists about teaching?
It's unfortunate. I mean, some of it is we need to professionalize the work. And I think some of it is the conditions. Some of it is the respect. I think in this country, we still have the idea that everyone can teach, really, that it doesn't really take that much, all that much. And then some of it, you know, in places like Baltimore is almost seen as like a mini martyrdom, that somehow you have to be larger than life to want to do this work. And I think we have to be careful. You know, we have to be careful as a culture that we don't slip into this kind of anti-intellectualism, you know, that is so often girded in what we do. And some of it, frankly, is and I can say this because I am an educator, we've watered down how we communicate about the craft. We do one of two things. We either make it so complex and use so much jargon that everyday people are like, whoa, it shouldn't take all of that. Or we don't communicate effectively enough about just how deeply you do need to know content to teach well. And so we kind of dismiss it all as process. And the fact that I was incredibly fortunate and blessed to have teachers, particularly in junior high and high school, who knew their content very, very deeply. And, you know, I went to public schools and to smaller Catholic parochial schools, but I had teachers who knew their content deeply. And I think some of that is as a culture, we really have to shift where we place our value. And really, when teaching is done well, it's absolutely a beautiful thing of art, but it's not when it is done well. It's an amazing blend of deep, deep content knowledge with an understanding of how to break down the content in a way that connects with young people. And it's not easy to do if you've ever done it.
How did you decide to go to Brown, and what was your experience like there?
So Brown, for me, believe it or not, I actually thought, and this is no disrespect to anybody who's gone to Duke, but throughout high school, I really lived and died to go to Duke. I thought that's where I wanted to go. Now it's funny looking back on it. And I went there and it didn't really click for me. And I'm sure it's clicked for other people. When I went to Brown, what impressed me was how transparent folks there were. The campus was in the middle of, and I've said this in other places, was in the middle of real strong conversations about divestment in South Africa as a university. And Black students on campus, Latino students on campus, were advocating for larger numbers of faculty of color, were taking over, you know, college halls and things. And when I talked to students about race relations on campus, got real answers. And I felt like at other schools that I visited at the time, like including Duke, I felt like I was getting sugar-coated answers. And I've always been someone who wants it straight. And so that was really what drove me to Brown, was I said people here were real and they told me the real deal, and I felt like I wasn't gonna get sideswiped. And then I went there and it so matched me. It just did. It was a wonderful collection of scholars who loved kind of coffee shop scholarship rather than formal academia. And that fit me because I tend to be more conservative just as a person. So the amount of freedom that Brown gives matched me well, because it helped loosen me up a little bit just in terms of my thinking and my dialogue, but it gave me the space. And it's one of the reasons why I say to people, I was not educated not to question. And I've been very, very fortunate. I had Jesuit teachers in high school, Sisters of Notre Dame, who just opened up the depth of content, but were very character-based in terms of how you do the work, right? So a lot of the, I think, psych trips that high-achieving students of color have to go through in terms of questioning their intelligence, I didn't have to go through that until college. When I hit Brown, there was more of that. But in high school, I was one of the few African-American students and never ever felt like my intelligence was questioned, because in that parochial Catholic school setting, it was all about doing the work. That's what made you smart, right? Getting your work done, being able to produce. And a number of my friends who went through other settings, and I'm even mindful of this today as CEO in the city, it was all about tracking. It was all about prove if you're really smart. Did you get this number on this test to get in the high track or the AP track? And in my high school experience, it was all about the work you produced. You know, I'll never forget, God bless her, Sister Judith Nee, who I think is passed now. And she reamed out one of the kids in our class who had near perfect SAT scores. And I remember her saying, I don't really care about your SAT scores because what you turned into me was junk. And that was the kind of high school experience I had, where it was about your character, it was about your work ethic, and it was about the behaviors of being an intellectual, not about, whereas a lot of my friends who went to highly, highly tracked schools always felt like their intelligence was on trial. And so it was a real gift to be given that. And I carry that with me even now as CEO, and even when I was CAO, of what are the signals we're sending to our young people. And I was really fortunate. So then when I got to Brown and there was much more of that pecking order kind of thing, it actually made me work my tail off. And I just started getting A's, kept getting A's. And I turned around one day and thought, oh, I guess I really am, right? I guess I really am doing it. But I think it was really key that in those four critical years of high school, I was able to practice being an academic and intellectual and never feel as if, because I was African-American, my intelligence was on trial. And so many of my friends had that. And I felt that at Brown. Like, you walk into class, people are like, well, are you really in the right class? Are you supposed to be? And I never had that. Like, I walked into an honors class or an AP class and the teachers were all like, hey, Sonia, how are you? And I have stories of friends of mine who, you know, were getting 4 and 5s on AP Calc, but would walk, you know, AB, but then walk into another AP class and people would look down at the roster and say, are you sure you're in the right class? And I just really think it was a gift that at the height of my kind of K-12 academic development, I didn't have any of that. Nobody ever questioned whether I was smart. It was all about, do you have the disciplines to be able to demonstrate that you are part of the academy? And it was a real gift. And I think too often in public education in particular, we're so busy trying to peck and see, is a kid really, really smart, that I didn't have that psych trip. And I'm very, very glad now, many moons later.
So tell me about your early days in teaching and in academia, and what was the learning curve like? What were some of the adjustments?
Ooh, there were a number of them. Like, I remember, I'll never forget, like, you know, I was up at Columbia taking classes and I had learned, you know, this, you know, writer's workshop and, you know, just give the kids literature and they'll be, you know, this and that. And I'm sure, you know, I was a young teacher, so I wasn't doing it well. And coming back and just complete mayhem, like just went miserably wrong. I didn't have the systems in place. You know, I just thought kids would magically engage in conversation and they didn't. So those were big learning years for me. I was very fortunate in that my early days teaching were very gradual. I actually don't have a lot of the horror stories that some of our first-year teachers, unfortunately, in the city have, of just kind of being dropped in a class and saying, go for it. You know, I got to teach classes at a variety of different grade levels before I kind of settled and focused in middle school. I remember I had kindergarten for a week and thought, oh my God, this is the most exhausting thing I've ever done. And so a lot of how I think about being inducted into teaching is shaped by those early experiences. And then very early on, made the connection, like teaching in Bedford-Stuyvesant and having the privilege of being part of a new school that was forming. So I wasn't, again, going like lone soldier into an already existing. I was part of a team of people who were starting a new school. So very early, the power connections between teaching, community, vitality, as well as the sense of self that young people have was very, very present for me. And again, that kind of straight talk that I think was part of my own and education and hard work and the way that I was raised transferred over to my teaching. So I believed and fortunately worked with people who believed you tell kids whether they're on grade level. And at the time, this was kind of pre-No Child Left Behind, when all the data was just kind of mushed in together and wasn't disaggregated. You know, I remember having a conversation with a student who was in fifth grade, who I just said, you know, you can't, you know, you're not at grade level. And she interpreted it as, I can't read. And, you know, she looked and said, nobody ever told me you know, that I couldn't. And so this idea of being real about the targets, but then helping kids get there is in the fiber of who I am, that it's not just enough. And, you know, we even have some people now who are just have this kind of, if you make it, you make it, and you really got it, or you don't. And that's never been how I've approached the work. It's always been, you're real about the standard, you're real about where a student is according to that standard, but it is all about, it's all about the supports to get you there. And I'm in this with you. This is not about who just you are. It's about both of us together. And it's about a caring relationship that allows me to hold you accountable. You know, I've never presumed, I learned very early teaching when I like went off on a class of fifth graders. And, you know, thought I was being, you know, just taking control and da da da. I'll never forget the one young man who just burst out laughing.
Oh, no.
And, I mean, it was just, and I realized it was a wonderful reminder. And even now as a mother, right, it's a wonderful reminder that, you know, just screaming your head off, like it might give you some release of steam at some point, but that's not how you motivate kids. It's not how you hold them accountable. You hold them accountable based on your relationship. Like my three young daughters do things for me because I have a relationship with them, because they know I'm invested in them. I mean, it doesn't mean I don't raise my voice, but those are the kinds of lessons in those early days that I learned from teaching and teaching in Bed-Stuy. And it's not about looking the same as your kids, because there are a lot of young people who looked like their students. But if you're not really good at teaching and you don't really relate to them, you know, I mean, I looked like them, but I didn't grow up the way they did. But there is a mutual respect that regardless of who you are, regardless of your background, young people know whether you respect them. They know whether you are invested in them or you are another passing fancy. And the things that they will do for an adult who is invested in them and holds them accountable through relationship, not just because you have some authoritarian trip you're on, is amazing. And I watch it every day in our city, that difference plays out.
Yeah, kids can just cut to your core like nobody else. I've never been a teacher, but just in babysitting experiences, I have similar stories.
Yeah, you know, if you babysit, you know that power. That's right.
Well, I was hoping to talk more about that relationship with the students and how your background is not similar to them. You didn't grow up like a lot of these poor Baltimore City kids grew up. Sure. What are the challenges in relating to their experiences and also with the parents of the school district?
Well, one of the things that, I mean, it is challenging to the extent that, right, you don't have all of the same relationships, right? So there we have teachers, we have folks who work in our schools who know exactly, I mean, I don't want to say exactly, but who have walked similar paths. And that is profoundly valuable. And we need more of those folks in our schools. But what teaching in Bed-Stuy has taught me, what relating to parents as an administrator, as a building leader, you know, as someone who has had leadership positions in a school, again, I go back to the respect factor. And that part plays out. You know, I also do code shifting. I don't talk in the same dialect, right, that I do here. And I'm able to code shift. So I do have that, you know, that going for me. But I've always, you know, and this is part of the international relations part of me, right, that it's about mutual respect. It's about hearing. And it is about responding through authenticity. I haven't had as many of those issues. And some of it is restraining judgment, like reserving judgment, and being able to respond to people's need gives you credibility, like the ability to listen, respect, and respond. I think that gets you further than whether you grew up down the street from somebody. Because you can grow up down the street from somebody and still be disrespectful. You can come from a similar background and still see kids as thugs and not have the lift that you could. And so for me, I haven't had as many of those obstacles because that is how I operate. And that is my track record. And that is going all the way back to being in Bedford-Stuyvesant until now. You know, the way that you de-escalate an irate parent is you listen, right? You know, you don't. And I remember breaking up a fight between a mom and her son and just saying to her, look, I get it. He disrespected you, but I need you to get that. I can't let you. I can't let you do this publicly because you're going to make me have to call legal, call police to get involved because I'm bound to. So let's go and have a conversation, right? We're going to give him some time. We're going to give you some time and let's go have a conversation. And it, I mean, 85% of the time, 90% of the time that works. You do have the outliers. But you know, I have outliers from all income levels and strata. I mean, I've gone toe-to-toe with parents who are incredibly well-educated and have significant economic means. So it's not just certain kinds of parents are cranky. I mean, they're cranky right. parents. But I think all parents, if we operate from the perspective that they really want what's best for their children to the extent that they understand what that is, that helps. That helps a whole lot. But not with young people and not with, you know, not with families. And I think the more, that's what I've been promoting since being back to the city. We have to respect where people are coming from. We have to be willing to listen. We can't continue to hold our community at arm's length as if, you know, in some cases, you know, as if they're a leper colony or if, you know, as if we've got to lock down our schools to the point of no return. And we've got to equip our school people and our central office people and what that looks like. Like it takes skill to be able to do that. I always thought that was a given. But, you know, de-escalation is connected. De-escalation of any conflict, again, going to my international relations background, you know, requires certain techniques. There are certain techniques and procedures. And not everybody is as skilled in what those are. So part of what we're looking to do, even within the school system, is to help train people on what to do. How do you send the signal that you value people, right? I've been talking with folks about our translation services. And yes, we still do not have an overwhelming majority of our families in city schools that do not have English as their first language, but we have a growing number. And what does it say when we don't have school signs that are in home languages as well as English? What does it say when we don't have a native speaker, right, calling to talk to a family? Like, what does that communicate about what we feel about you and how we view you? What does it mean when we say to parents, you can't visit your child's class without going through 50 steps? Like, what does that signal? And so a lot of the work that we're trying to do is recognize those signals and give people the skills to be able to de-escalate.
You have a lot of experience in academia, academic planning, but in your new-ish role, I guess you've been in it since July 1st, I mean, you are a CEO, you're dealing with budgets and staffing and all of that.
Yeah.
What has that adjustment been like to you and what parts of the job don't come as naturally to you?
That's a great question. So I think the biggest area has been things like building construction, has been some of the maintenance and operational issues. I've been knee-deep in things like air conditioning, roofing, building schools, beyond just what does it take to get a school community ready, but what is good enough, right? Like how many windows? What's the cost of repeated vandalism? So the operational, those kinds of operational maintenance, building construction pieces do not come as naturally to me. They're not, I don't know that work as intimately as I know other work, but I know schools enough to know that those things need to run so I can ask the right questions. And again, it's my training, right? My education is to, even if you don't understand, even if something is you don't know deeply, you begin by asking critical questions. And so that's what I've done. I said to someone after 3 weeks getting ready to go on the job, and they said, oh, it must be so nice to be immersed in teaching and learning again. I said, well, it's funny you said that because actually it's been, you know, very, very small percentage of my job. But the way that I approach things is always through the lens first of the school, and then everything else emanates out from that. Budgets I'm fairly comfortable with just from previous administrative positions. It's just larger and more areas. So the finance piece is not as daunting in that I've headed up nonprofits, I've had other positions in school systems. And so there it is more, how do you bring that all together? I'm probably spending far more of my time on the analytics of finance and the public interaction of finance, right? We've got school funding formula coming up. But having spent time in DC for the last 3 years with an advocacy organization, you know, I've had greater exposure to school funding formulas from state perspective. And again, it all goes back to the school. So if we don't have a full understanding of finance, then you don't really understand resourcing of schools. You have to understand finance. And then staffing, what's been great is learning more about the details of kind of human capital work. But again, that's an area that, based on previous positions, I'm familiar with. It's more connecting the tissue around the central functions that support that. But having had previous positions in central office as CAO, you know, when I was in Baltimore, we worked as an integrated team. So, you know, I worked with the chief human capital officer and the chief operating officer for that. So, you know, coming back, even though operations is not my immediate specialty, for lack of a better term, I'm not unfamiliar with it because of previous roles. So that's one of the nice parts about this kind of work and having been part of a team that's an interrelated, integrated team, or at least was striving to be. It meant that I did have my hands in those pots, even though I was officially the chief academic officer.
You have described yourself in regards to education as an elitist. I was hoping you could tell me more about what you meant by that.
Sure. So, and it's funny because if I had realized in saying it, it would hound me for years. But yeah, but I am. And I think it's because, and what I mean by that is, I'm an elitist in believing that everyone is capable of complex thought, and that complex thought should not be the purview of a small select group of people. I don't believe that there are vastly different tracks of what kids need to know and understand. I mean, one of the things that I love when I'm in New York and meeting people from all over the world is that you have taxi cab drivers who can talk about Camus with you, that you have writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates, right, who can reference Othello and make connections to what he's writing about for reparations, right? Like, that's what I mean by I'm an elitist. I'm an elitist in the sense that for people who think it doesn't take all of that, I think it does. I think every student should be comfortable reading an African novel as well as one from 19th century England, right? And be able to make connections between the colonization of West Africa and what's currently going on in other parts of the world. I believe everyone should know world history and should know it from both where they sit and where they may not. And so in that way, I'm an elitist. I think everyone should feel comfortable enough with numbers, not that they win a Fields Medal, certainly, but that they shouldn't see a bar graph. They shouldn't have statistics in front of them. They shouldn't have a spreadsheet that they don't understand and feel anxiety about that. So when I say I'm an elitist, that's what I mean, that I'm just elitist enough to believe that everybody should have that. So I guess it's a weird blend of elitism as well as populism, but a lot of things that people consider and elite education, I think of as being a complete education. So that's what I mean when I say I'm an elitist.
So do people tend to underestimate Baltimore City students, and who are the people who do?
In answer to your question, yes. Right. And that's where I think I first said I was an elitist, because there are large numbers of folks who actually don't think that all of our students are capable of complex thought. They want everything to be spoon-fed, broken down, little pieces, to the point where it's not even interesting. I mean, you know yourself as a reporter. What makes reading interesting, what makes finding out more interesting, is the ability to look at things from different vantage points, to infer, to concur, to disagree. And when we take that away from our young people, we turn them off to, one, just academic thought, period, whether it's formal schooling or not. And we actually send a signal to them that you are not capable of complex thought, which then embeds, perhaps unintentionally, but certainly in a very undercover way, communicates there are certain areas of life that are cut off to you. And I tell people, I am not a doctor because I chose not to be one, not because I don't think I'm capable of being one. That was not where my drive was. That was not what I wanted to do. It's not because, ooh, I'm not good at math. I didn't become a doctor, or I didn't become an engineer because it doesn't drive me. Math doesn't send me through the loop-de-loops like it does my nephew, who would do it all day long if possible, right? And I think we do have people who underestimate. I think we have too many educators who underestimate. We have too many administrators. All walks of life. I think that the interesting piece is from all walks of life, from all vantage points, we have people who underestimate our kids, and then we have people right next door who believe in their infinite potential. And so the question is, how do we get critical masses of people from all areas of life in this city to believe in the infinite potential of our young people? I believe if Baltimore can create one Westmore, there's another one out there somewhere. If Baltimore has one DeRay McKesson, there's another one out there somewhere, right? And so this piece for me is really about how do we find those young people who are who have those gifts and talents, and those gifts and talents are sometimes just being a fantastic mom and dad. Like, we need more fantastic moms and dads in this city. And so it's not to say that everyone's going to win a Nobel Prize, but I've said in one other interview I did years ago, that I am still of the belief that if you educate young people as if everyone is a potential neurobiologist, everyone is a potential discoverer of a new art form, everyone is a potential president, everyone is a potential entrepreneur waiting to discover the next, fantastic service or discovery. If we do that, then we educate the population very differently. We educate all kids to lead. And that's what I mean by that. Like, I tell teachers this, I tell administrators this, lead from your space, right? My grandmother, neither of my grandmothers went to four-year college, but they led. Like, one of my grandmothers led from her place as an African-American woman in the segregated South from her church. And she was an amazing leader that way. I have another, my dad's mom, who was widowed with six kids in Mississippi in segregationist South, four of whom were boys, none of whom went to jail, all of whom were college educated. She cleaned Klans members' houses, but then taught school. And she was a leader. She led. And no, she doesn't have a Nobel Prize next to her name. She didn't win a Pulitzer, but she was educated even in that segregated setting to believe that she had greatness in her. And so she passed that on to her children and her grandchildren. And so I just believe that we educate kids differently if we're educating them to lead. It feels differently. That's what Brown taught me. I went to Brown, and you walk through those gates and you are educated as if you are going to lead something when you leave there. And so it's different, right? You're asked to push and to question. And in too many classrooms around Baltimore, kids who push and ask questions end up in a corner, right? End up in a principal's office instead of redirected. I talk to young people all the time, and I'll say, is the work you're doing, like, is this too easy, too hard? They're like, yeah, it's kind of easy. And then, we give them something really challenging later on, and they hit a wall, and they don't know how to deal. They don't know how to persevere. And then they end up internalizing that they're not smart. They're not capable. So it's this just weird combination we have that we've really got to push through. And we have teachers who do that all over the city, which is, I guess, wheat and chaff or whatever you want to call it. For every classroom I go in where I say, that's a little low level. We need to push that a bit. I go in another one where just the opposite is taking place. I got to visit the summer program the Advanced Placement Summer Program that Baltimore City runs, very kind of a program that has been reduced, unfortunately, over the last couple of years that we're going to build back up. And I just saw teachers there who taught advanced placement during the year, working with kids from a variety of different levels, and not all of the kids were necessarily ready for AP in the traditional sense, but those teachers were teaching them content in a way that was accessible yet still very rigorous. And I thought to myself after visiting those classrooms, like, this is what it's supposed to look like. This is what it's supposed to look like to help kids who might have gaps actually catch up. And one of the things that we unfortunately do, and again, this is something I've said in other settings, is we tend to, as educators for kids that are behind, slow things down. Break it down to its just finest point, when really what we need to be doing is accelerating. We need to give them more. We need to give them more deeply. We need to give them more experiences. And it's so funny that we give kids that are behind, we give it to them slow and we give it to them less. We give young people coming from poverty impoverished learning experiences, right? So we make their classrooms danker. We give them more worksheets. We give them less opportunities to invent, right? We give them less opportunities to explore. But then I go to schools that educate large numbers of young people from very educated homes, wealthier homes, homes where parents expect a certain level. And I go in there and there's all kinds of enrichment. All kinds of enrichment. Kids aren't just sitting behind a desk all day. They're designing their own robots and they are designing their own community betterment projects, right? They're raising money to be sent across the world to discover like a new way of serving refugee children somewhere. Like, but we don't give, right, our kids who actually need more, those kinds of experiences. We give them the watered down, paltry stuff. And the kids that already are coming with so much, we give them even more. And then we wonder why we have these disparate results. You know, we have the kids who we've invested in. You know, everybody says, oh, kids these days. And, oh, the kids are off the hook. Well, frankly, we have the kids that we've invested in. Our investment has shown.
It seems like there is, among some circles, this kind of like defeatist attitude. You were talking about families and coming from the more educated and wealthy families. And maybe this is just because I have to read the Baltimore Sun comments all day long.
God bless you.
Yes, which I would not wish on anyone. But, you know, there's like this idea that if kids aren't getting reinforcement in the home, they're hopeless in the classroom. I mean, how do you respond to something like that?
Well, we have, look, I do not disagree with the fact that it is easier when you have a whole community, including families, and first and foremost families, who are keyed in, buy in, and support the educational schooling process. Of course it is. I think the question, though, is why are we not focusing on the schools and the classrooms who actually are getting results with those same kids, right? We always default to the majority as what is inevitable versus looking at the outliers for what is possible. And I think that's what really irritates me about that. Like people always default to, well, we know, we put all this money in. And again, I don't read the Sun comments anymore either because, frankly, they're too depressing. And I just don't want that circling in my head anymore. So good tip for you for doing
no,
that.
No, I would recommend you stay on your path.
That's right. Yeah. but a lot of it is, you know, I walk into schools and classrooms that are doing it. Right, that are doing it with those same kids. So when will we as a society invest as deeply? And by invest, I don't mean just pouring in more money, although certainly funding is a big deal. But why won't we invest our expectation, our promise, our efforts in saying, well, it's happening over there. What are they doing, right? How do we replicate that? We have programs, partnerships in this city that are doing amazing things for kids. And so we should be asking and getting great results. So why aren't we asking, how do we expand that? Why aren't we asking, how do we bring that to scale? I tell people, what keeps me up at night is not, can it be done? That was resolved for me a long time ago. It really was. The real question for me, what keeps me up at night, is how do I bring it to scale? How do I get 180 plus schools online, high performing, providing high quality learning experiences that are responsive and rigorous for kids? But not, can it not happen? And I think we choose to fixate on the majority of the results as the inevitability. And I don't have that frame. And frankly, I don't think most visionaries throughout history have gone with what is common. They have gone with the outlier, and they have asked, how do I blow out this outlier so that it has greater impact for the greater good? My husband's an entrepreneur, and one of the things that he says about, like, the founder of, I think it was Coca-Cola, if you look at Apple, that what distinguishes some of those companies and those endeavors is they did not seek to create, I think even Henry Ford, right? They did not seek to create a niche, right? Like this kind of exclusive. I mean, we have companies that do that, like, you know, companies that just want to cater to a particular class. But if you look at those examples in particular, which is what he does as an entrepreneur, what you see is people who had a vision for bringing something to the masses that the masses could use, that were not just focused on exclusivity. And that's why you notice I said, yeah, I'm an elitist in terms of the fact that I think everybody should have what some consider elite knowledge, but I am a populist when it comes to where our impact needs to be. And so I have just embraced, and maybe that's why I married an entrepreneur, I've just embraced that I'm the kind of person who looks for the exception and thinks about how do you bring it to scale. And you know, which is why I can't spend time in your comment pages, because those are folks that are fixated. And my dad used to say to me, because he's a stats guy, he's a former chemist and used to teach stats. And he warned me when I went to grad school and then even when I went to work in Washington. And I remember calling him and saying, my God, I just keep looking at all these stats all day long. And everybody's talking about gap and deficiency and da da da. And he said, Sonia, I learned a long time ago, if I looked at all of the statistics on African-American men in this country, he said, I wouldn't have made it past 19. And what you need to focus on is, and he basically said the same thing to me, you've got to focus on who are the people who are getting it done, and then what is it from those experiences that we expand. And that's what we need to do a better job of in city schools. Where are the classrooms? Where are the teachers? Where are the schools? And even if they're not totally there yet, we have schools that are still outperforming their peer group in Baltimore. Not where they need to be, but like one of the things I said in my state of schools, we have schools that are outperforming their band group, and they're doing it for a population of kids that based on family background, experiences, income, whole 10 yards, should not be performing where they're performing. So let's look at those schools. And we need to invest in schools that are committed to accelerating kids that are behind, not doing dead remediation that only kills any love of learning that a young person would have.
What kind of educational choices have you had to make for your own children? And what do you hope most that they are getting from their education?
Yeah, so one of the things when we moved here that, and we've been very, very fortunate in that the school where all of our daughters up until this year, but up in, through last year chose was a very warm environment. But I think what we looked for was a school that had enough structure, you know, that our daughters would develop an understanding of the core. And by that, I don't mean Common Core. I mean like the core of academic knowledge, and a school that was willing to take me being pushy and all of my things. And we found that. And we found a school that was very much family, where people didn't just know my children's names because I worked in the system, but knew everybody's children's names. And I remember when my husband and I were visiting potential schools when we came to Baltimore, and this school shall definitely remain nameless. But we left one, and my husband said, the girls can't go there. And I said, well, why? It's, you know, highly regarded. But he said, because, you know, principal didn't know all the kids' names, you know, that they were stumbling. And our kids are known, and that's very important. We are responded to as parents. It doesn't mean there aren't areas they need to work on, but those are things that I've looked for. And one of the things that I say to everyone, like when we were getting ready for school, you know, opening of school, you know, I used to say to people, if you wouldn't leave your child in this classroom, then it's not ready. It's not ready. And that's how I make that estimation. Our oldest daughter is in a new school this year. Our oldest daughter is. And some of that is because of who she is as a learner. And she is a kid who needs to be doing. Like, she's a kid who loves the projects, who loves computers, who her fourth, I think it was her third grade teacher, told me she collected a pond sample. This was 2 years ago when she was in third grade. And she stood there longer than anybody in the class in the water because she wanted a perfect pond sample. And she's been that way since she's been a baby. And she's a kid that doesn't do well with high levels of stress. She's very much needs to be nurtured. It's why she did well in her schools before. But she loves science and she loves math. And, you know, she wanted a setting. She needed a setting that would have all of that because she just you know, she loves it, but she can also get very anxious, particularly around math. And I needed her to be in a setting where her anxiety would not short circuit her love for science. She is her grandfather's granddaughter. Like, my dad is a chemist, and I call him, he was a professional chemist, but an amateur naturalist. And she is probably closer to being a professional naturalist, and you know, because her math, she still has, you know, math anxiety we have to work on. But she just loves that. So we had to make that decision, and we'll make decisions for each of our girls that are commensurate with who they are as people. And my husband and I make those decisions together. But we've been very fortunate in that we've had great options here in the city and around us. So. That's what we've done.
So we talked about you coming from a highly educated background mm-hmm. into this poor school system. That in combination with your secret hiring, I wonder to what extent has trust building been a part of your job?
That's a great question. And it has been. Like, I mean, very, very explicitly coming in. And I was fortunate in that I had relationships and I had a track record that other people could point to. You know, I had a way that I do the work that hasn't changed. I mean, it's, you know, the context of it has changed being CEO, but that actually has helped immensely. If, you know, the process had been reacted to the way that it was and I hadn't had that, it would have been a lot harder. But people, at least for me directly, have been very warm, very welcoming. I think people want, I mean, that's one thing I can say about Baltimore, regardless of all the little commenters on your, you know, articles that you have to read. I will say most of the people I meet have very good will, intentions, and hope for the school system. I mean, some people tell me, yeah, you know, I hope you're okay. But just, I would say overwhelming majority of folks that I meet are excited about the potential of the school system and our schools for our young people. So the trust building, I think, is a long-term thing, though. Like, it's one thing for people to be excited, you know, that you're here or you're back or the potential. I think the trust building is going to be, and I said this in my State of Schools address, it's how we do the work that really builds the trust, right? Don't promise 15 things if you can only deliver on two. And if you promise two, then by God, deliver on the two you promised, right? So follow through. Transparency. Right. A lot of the kind of hot button issues that people usually reference, you know, when they're saying, how's your transition going? I think, you know, yes. Are there some gnarly things we're going to have to figure out? Absolutely. But a lot of it is based on trust. A lot of it is based on trust. And one of my favorite quotes that I've been adopting most recently is Ronald Reagan's trust but verify, which I learned from one of your colleagues today didn't originate with him, but that he made popular. And I'm going to revive it. It's trust but verify. And, you know, I have to trust my team to be able to get things done. But they also know I'm going to verify. So I go out and I visit schools, not as much as I'd like to. I can't spend all day in schools, but I go visit schools. And yes, I'm going to trust that you're going to get it done, but I'm also going to verify that you're going to get it done. And I think that the public should do the same thing. So when I get emails from parents saying, I tried to get this, this, and this three times, and it didn't happen, that's a problem. And if no one is communicating with you along the way, that's a problem. If a first-year teacher, and we rectified this, can't get a response back about something on their paycheck because they've got to go through 50 different transfers and everything, that's a problem. But we've got to be honest and direct and transparent about what we can do and what we can't. And I have found that when we do that and when we own up to when we fall short, you know, not to perpetrate as if everything was perfect and you're just crazy if you didn't experience it well, but to really say, wow, okay, we missed it on that one. How? Because we're a huge bureaucracy still. I mean, we are. We're a huge, huge organization. So we're not going to get it perfect. We employ far too many imperfect humans to get everything perfect. But what is our willingness to acknowledge that we messed up? And what's our willingness to clarify and correct? And acknowledging we're going to agree to disagree sometimes. You know, and I was here, not everything I did principals love. you know, I said to folks early on, and everybody was like, oh, we're so happy you're back, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, let's see if you feel that way in 3 months. Because, but, you know, I have to be who I am. And that's part of leading, right? That it's not personal. It's about stewardship of the system. But we have to do our work in a way that communicates integrity, or at least a commitment to integrity. Like I said, we're a huge organization. You know, we're going to have mistaken hires, you know, on people. We're going to have, unfortunately, adults that don't do not so great things for kids. But are we going about the work with a level of transparency and integrity and forthrightness that allows people to say, like, I know where you stand? And that's really what I want. I want to go about the work ethically, with authenticity, with rigor. We're not paying people to be on lounge chairs. And it's not fair if somebody's working their butt off over here, getting amazing results, iterating, and somebody else in whatever position, I'm not just talking about teachers, I'm talking about whatever position, is kind of coasting. Like, I just don't think that's fair. And I have to model it. It has to be modeled from the top. We can't have, we still have, unfortunately, too much of kind of a lockdown culture in Baltimore's city schools. And, you know, it starts with locking, let's clamp down on the kids, right? Like, God forbid we let our pre-Kers up and actually go to some center time, right? All the way to, you know, locking down on principals. And we just need to, you know, we need to develop, we need to do the work in a way that communicates we're all leading from our space, because we are educating kids who will lead. Leaders in anything don't get stuff chopped up in nice, neat little pieces. So, you know, we've been working with the team on, you have to anticipate. This is not about just, well, nobody told me to do that. You have to anticipate if you're going to work in city schools. You have to be able to adjust and adapt. And I think that combined with transparency on things like funding, I think will get us a long way. I think it's a great place to start anyway. And then I'm sure once we get further down the line, I'll come up with what the next things are.
Well, maybe all the principals can't say the same, but I was certainly happy to have you here. Dr. Santelices, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. PT, she a dope girl, dope girl, dope girl.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Female Trouble. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We're also online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble and on SoundCloud. Feel free to email me at qkelly@baltsun.com or tweet us at FMLTrouble if you have anyone you'd like to suggest for the podcast. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next Tuesday.